Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, November 16, 2015, during a live telephone conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be speaking with Victor Davis Hanson. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those for the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. At the outset, I want to let you know that this is a special 40-minute call. We have the Victor Davis Hanson until about 20 of. We're going to begin with opening remarks by him, and then, as always, opening remarks of about 7 to 8 minutes. But the bulk of the call, as always, will be on your questions, so please do be thinking of your questions in the interim. When we get to that point, I'll make the customary announcement, and we'll spend the balance of our time on the questions. With that, Victor Davis Hanson, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I would like just to frame the dilemma that we're in. We're a postmodern society in which nationalism, patriotism, ideas of deterrence, classical notions of how to wage and especially win wars are sort of passé. We saw that when the president this morning said that he wasn't posing or pursuing some notion, I think he said, of American leadership or American winning, in the way that in the 2008 campaign he disparaged the passe notion of wearing an American flag. And we are against an enemy in radical Islam that's pre-modern in the sense that their worldview about most of the things we take for granted, meritocracy, a multiracial society under the aegis of consensual government, freedom, Bill of Rights, popular culture, all that is an anathema to 7th century Islam. And ostensibly, we shouldn't worry. We have the technology, we have the military power, we have all the advantages. We could crush ISIS in a second, supposedly, in the way that the French and the British and the Dutch and the Belgium in 1940 had an army. It was a million people larger than Germany. It had more tanks, it had more planes, and yet it lost. And that's somewhat analogous, is that what we lack in our postmodern cynicism is we either are afraid to lose the quality of our popular life that we enjoy by some sacrifice, or we feel that we'll be guilty, or we will not be seen as magnanimous by our enemies if we were to fight an existential war, or we just lost through our educational system any idea of what it was to be an American and or a Westerner, and what it, how you can define it and whether it's better than the alternative. And the result is, to finish, we create an alternate reality. The president does that especially well with terrorism becomes a man-caused disaster. The struggle against it becomes an overseas contingency operation. Workplace violence characterizes mass murder. Jihad is a personal journey. Muslim Brotherhood is largely secular. And then we kind of had this denouement. When ISIS is JV, it's contained. John Kerry says its days are numbered. And Al Gore is perched up on top of the Eiffel Tower, tweeting and doing a webcast why this terrorism threat below him transpires while he assures the world that the chief threat to it is carbon. So I guess to conclude, it's a question of willpower and a question of intellect and a question of spirit. Our enemies say that we're decadent and we're exhausted and we're a 21st century civilization on the wane. We say that as good progressives, they're just they don't really believe it. They're just confused, and human nature changes, and through the progressive engine of more capital, more education, more empathy, more understanding. Hillary Clinton, who says that the enemy, we have to reach out to the enemy, as she said not too long ago, or Madonna more crassly just recently, we feel that we can change our view. And so we have two different views of the world, one of the 7th and one of the 21st century, and I don't think we're winning. And with that pessimistic appraisal, I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Very good. We are off and running. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, we have about 35 minutes remaining. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got quite a few people on the phone with us today, as expected. So I'm going to ask our callers to be as succinct as possible with your questions, if you could be. Let's take our first call now.
Good afternoon, Dr. Hansen. I'm calling from the heartland in Indianapolis, and I'm interested to hear, please, your worldview, your description of the president's worldview that leads him to the action or inaction that seems to dominate his approach to these world issues.
Thank you. I'll try to be very brief because it's a pretty simple worldview, and that is that in the generic sense, human nature changes. It's malleable if you have liberal institutions. You can disabuse people of things like religion or politics, and you can bring them over to your side if you're empathetic enough. And I'll just direct you to the Cairo speech or the El Arabia interview, where he just basically created mythologies because he thought that this would make people feel good about themselves and especially good about us. And then more specifically, he believes the post-war order was a flawed concept that was based on imperialism, neocolonialism, in which the United States alienated the Soviet Union, inherited the aegis of British colonialism, and is sort of a 1% abroad as the 1% exercises undue influence at home. It was then his unique destiny to come into the world to save us, save the world from this American imperial hegemony by apologizing, contextualizing dangers, treating our traditional allies as suspect, our traditional enemies, whether Cuba or China or Venezuela, as either neutrals or friends, Iran especially. And the result would be a more balanced, fair world in which China would have an hegemony, Putin would have an hegemony, Iran would have an hegemony. We would all be equals. Nobody would be exceptional. And we would have sort of a quality of result abroad as we do at home.
This is Dean, Dr. Hansen. You mentioned in your opening, I think you speculated that maybe we as a people want to be seen as magnanimous by our enemies, which strikes me as maybe not inaccurate, but a peculiar thing. What is it about our culture that leads us to that end, do you think?
It makes us want to be magnanimous?
To our enemies in particular.
I think it's a traditional Western pathology that's been documented from Plato and Nietzsche and on, and then perhaps cynically by people like Oswald Spengler, and that is that the combination of free market capitalism and constitutional government creates a very leisured and affluent society, and it finds meaning the more it becomes secularized by its sense of self. And if it has no God, it creates its own God, which is sort of reason or fairness or liberality. And it can do all of this because really it distances itself from elemental challenges such as hunger, famine, death, disease, epidemics. So we in the West, and what I mean just to close out this answer very quickly is if we had 5 Paris attacks in a row, Barack Obama wouldn't today be telling everybody that we don't have to pose as if we're American, you know, superpower. He wouldn't say that. And if we have another 9/11, he won't say that. Just as if he gave everybody lectures about migrants or the tisk-tisk Ebola, he wouldn't say that if they turn out in a way that he doesn't expect. So we have a margin of error because of our economic and political systems. And that allows us to be complacent, kind of smug, and even preening in a very liberal way. But those fantasies, whether it's on Pearl Harbor or during the Korean War, they are 9/11. They do vanish when we feel that we're existentially threatened. But it's hard to existentially threaten the West as long as it's a meritocratic and free market capitalist and constitutional system. But we do have this weird artifact that occurs from it, when it's been chronicled by the Greeks and Romans. It's something we have to live with.
Interesting. We're talking with Dr. Victor Davis Hansen. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller now.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Hansen. My name is Jim Haynes. I'm a member of the Federalist Society. And I wondered if you could take at least a moment to move back a little bit from just the perspective of radical Islam and the notion of a caliphate and the notion of millions of people living in a world that we would say ceased to exist centuries ago. Obviously, it didn't for them. But is it, to some degree, a global phenomenon? I say that when I look at the People's Republic of China now seemingly trying to restore a kind of imperial boundary and imperial power and self-regard. And I also look at Russia, and I see Vladimir Putin and the impulse that obviously seems to grip a lot of Russians, that that somehow the Russian state and the Russian nationality and the Russian people need to recover something from the past. And so do we have two of the world's greatest powers actually at this point also kind of looking backward and trying to restore a history that they imagine, perhaps even a kind of theme park history that they wish had existed under Peter the Great or you know, the Tang Dynasty or whatever. Do you see it as larger than just the...
I do. I think that, I mean, Islam has gone through these... If we were having this conversation in the 30s, they would be Nazis. In the 40s and 50s, they would be pan-Arabists. In the 60s, Baathists. In the 70s, secular pro-Soviets. And then Islam fits their current mood, radical Islam. And by that I mean that all of these examples that you cite are people who are parasitic on Western technology and culture. The engine of it is in Europe and the United States, and yet when they look at the manifestations of it, they don't like it because it's not authoritarian, it's not patriotic, it's not nationalist, it's what they would call decadent. It blurs genders, it blurs classes, it blurs hierarchies. And they have some legitimate criticisms, obviously. And when their way of thinking, they can square the circle. They can have the Internet, they can have Google, they can have cell phones, and yet they don't have to go into market, radical market capitalism as we, and radical democracy that blurs all hierarchy. So they're trying to do something what they think is unique. We're going to be, we're going to have jet bombers, and we're going to have nuclear weapons, and we're going to have a very sophisticated, hip popular culture, but it's all going to represent traditional Chinese patriotism, nationalism, power in a way that's not true anymore of, say, Germany or Japan or the United States. Islam is the most egregious example of that.
Thank you.
We've got just four questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hi, Larry Callahan in California. Quick question. If you were at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, what would you be ordering the intelligence community, the U.S. intelligence community, to be doing differently than what we apparently, from what we know, they're doing now?
Well, we don't really know to what degree they're doing now because a lot of them are professionals. And while Obama may have a particular policy that prohibits them from using words like radical Islam, doesn't mean that out in the field that they obey that. And I guess what I'm saying is that we need more direct intelligence officers inside the Middle East. I don't know what the NSA is like after the Snowden episode, but I have a feeling that they're still collecting evidence. But all of that is just a tool that we can use if we want to destroy ISIS. That could be done by upping by a magnitude of 10 or 12, 20, the bombing sorties in conjunction with our European allies in the fashion that we did in the Balkans. And then, in addition, I don't mean arming the Kurds, I mean, or the Iraq, but really arming the Kurds. They have a propensity to fight. They don't give their weapons away or run to. And so we're not giving them enough weapons. We could do that, and then we could expand the 3,500 troops we have up to about 10,000, and then enlist the Jordanians, the Gulf monarchies, the Egyptians, and create a national force. And I think you could probably get rid of ISIS very quickly. There seems to be some pushback against that because we have two outliers, and that is to the degree that we get rid of ISIS, Putin thinks that helps his new arc of Iran, Hezbollah, Putin, Syria, and the pressure that they might exert on the Sunni moderates in the absence of American influence and power, and then also Iran. Iran sort of sees ISIS as blood sport. They kind of like the idea that these radical, crazy Islamic Sunni fundamentalist terrorists are causing havoc both for the West and for the so-called moderate Sunni regimes that are their enemies. So those two roles that Iran and Russia play are really make it more complicated than it has to be. But this whole thing that we're talking about today is a result of a perception, whether it's right or not. I think it is right that the Americans have abdicated power, and under no circumstances do they want to intervene. And they're exhausted after Afghanistan and Iraq and their failure in Libya. And they have a different type of commander who doesn't believe in the existing Western role as we've envisioned it since 1945. And in that vacuum, ISIS and other groups and Iran are going to take advantage of it.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller now.
Karen Lugo from Austin, Texas. Brian Kilmeade has a new book out which chronicles America's early conflict with the Barbary pirates and goes into more detail than many of us might have been aware of prior to this in telling about how the various pirate states began to demand actual gunships. And so paying tribute and then thinking of that getting to a point of actually providing the gunships that are being used against safe passage in these waters. Are there historical examples of countries, nation states that have been in such denial to some point waking up as we did in the past and confronting a reality like this and then doing something about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we don't have to even go back to the early 19th century. Anthony Eden records in his memoirs a conversation he had with Neville Chamberlain when he came back from Munich, and Chamberlain turned to Eden and said, you know, the more that I got to know Hitler and the more I think about what he's done, he's not a bad guy at all. This is after he'd already killed over 100,000 of his own people who were disabled and had chronic diseases and et cetera. So, and then the same thing, Mark Bloch wrote a great book on, called Strange Defeat, about the French, how they just simply imploded in 1940 and lost the war that they had fought 20 years earlier very successfully, but they just gave up and they were in denial. And you get the impression that certain Western societies at certain times feel that they've evolved to a particular point where the idea of victory or defeat, and you can see that when people say that there's no longer such a thing as a victory, and Obama said that. Of course, with Obama, you always get the historical confusion and ignorance when he said, you know, it's not like Tojo is going to go out on the Missouri and sign, which he never did, of course. But he deprecates these old-fashioned ideas of victory or defeat, and that's supposed to be unsophisticated. So we are so refined now. This is a warning also in Thucydides, where he said that the Athenians cultivate refinement, but without the loss of what he called masculinity, or without softness, malachi, I think is a Greek word. So that's a danger for us right now. We think that we're so smug and sophisticated that ISIS, who are they? They're just JVs. Come on, a bunch of ragtag guys that are homophobic and misogynist and don't believe in global warming. These people are nothing to take seriously. And yet there are people in the world outside the West who believe in things like beheading and incinerating people and drowning them because they'd like to. And, you know, it's sort of like Clint Eastwood in Dirty Harry when they ask, why does he do this? And he says he likes it. They like these sorts of things. They feel there's no downside to it, and they feel that human nature being what it is, people will be more attracted toward their power than repelled by their savagery. And unfortunately for us, that particular type of pre-modern view has coincided when we've had a singularly postmodern president. They're just like the antithetical extremes, and so... It makes it very dangerous in the next year, I think. I think this next year is going to be the most dangerous in 50 years in American foreign policy.
Once again, we're speaking with Dr. Victor Davis Hanson. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Good morning, Dr. Hansen, and thank you for speaking with us. I'm looking for a ray of optimism here. And so the question I have for you is, do you think Europe or the United States ultimately is going to lead the way in this battle against barbarism? I hope the answer is not neither.
It depends on the level of success on the part of ISIS. As it is now, I think pessimists who say that in a month or so the French will drop their guard again are probably correct. However, if there's another one, two, or three such attacks in places like Berlin or Madrid or London and Washington, New York, then I think people will take it seriously. We're sort of like the proverbial dog, and we're out there sort of lying in the sun, and we've got this tick, this parasite that likes us and doesn't quite want to kill us because it has nowhere to go. And that's what ISIS is. It loves the technology. It loves the wealth that comes in from the region, from oil, et cetera. It can't make any of the bomb, the C4 that it uses. It can't make a thing. It can't repair its cell phones. So it's parasitical, and it slowly weakens and makes sick the host and eventually probably kills it. But we don't feel it's a threat, just like a dog doesn't feel that the ticks are a threat until they get so bothersome that their daily life is interrupted. And when our daily life is interrupted, and it has been insidiously, anybody who flies, anybody who tries to speak on television or radio and butts up against political correctness can fathom just how radically life in America is different than it was prior to 9/11. But that's been an insidious and incremental change, and we're not even aware of it. But if they press it too much, and I think they would like to do that because they don't think that what we're talking about right now is serious, then I suppose that there's a lot of people in America that would rise up and demand action. The country still has about 55% of the people are sane, and they were willing to get angry and riled and make the necessary adjustments.
Let's take another call right away.
This is Mike Anderson, Orlando. I don't want to sound so much like a hawk, but isn't what Bush 41 did what we really need to do is go in and strike, solve the problem, get them out of Qatar, and get out? Did we gain a lot from doing that? And did we assert ourselves in a way that wasn't over, but also gave us a certain amount of influence and respect in the region? Thank you for your time.
Well, we have to go back and remember that after Bush did that, and we think it was successful, and James Baker is still claiming what a great success it was vis-a-vis W, he lost the election because the Kurds were massacred, the Shias were massacred, Saddam was there. We had 12 years of no-fly zone. We had cheating on the oil for food program. We had Abu Abbas. I would suggest you go back and look at the videos of Harry Reid and John Kerry and Hillary Clinton speaking in October 11th of 2002 about Iraq, about why we need to go in there. And so the idea was just to do what Clinton had done, bomb, or even what the elder Bush did, bomb and get out, had not solved the problem. So then we went in with 75% of the American people, congressional support in both houses. We got rid of Saddam. We had an insurrection. It was poorly handled. We paid a very stiff price in blood and treasure. And lo and behold, by 2009, when Barack Obama entered office, the average kill rate of Americans, if I could use that horrific term, was less than the accident rate in the U.S. military. And by the end of the first year, there was not a single American that died in December of 2009. The country was quiet. We had 20,000 to 30,000 people at Balad Air Base and other key places. The Iranians were out. We controlled the airspace of the Middle East. And we were evolving into a Korea-like scenario, just like Korea is today. And then Obama had a campaign, you know, talking point that he ended two wars, which explained, and he, Al-Qaeda was on the run, which explains his lies about Benghazi. And there we are today. I'll just finish with a good analogy would be, imagine Harry Truman, what he would think if Dwight Eisenhower, when he was up for election like Obama did, said, you know what, I didn't get us into Korea. That was Harry Truman that did that, and we've lost 36,000 dead and 150,000 wounded, and we didn't win. We still have troops there, and I'm going to bring everybody home and end this war. We've been there 4 years. It hasn't helped. It was a bad idea. We didn't win. We didn't understand the nature of Soviet, Chinese-inspired communism in North Korea. And I'm not going to send another American boy to get in there. We'll just bomb them and leave. And had we done that, there wouldn't be Samson and Kia today. So I think that whatever the mistakes we made in Iraq the second time, by 2009, the country was more stable than it was in 2000 or 1995 or 1997. It was pretty much on the road to a Korea-like evolution. So I think people will go back, and when all the rhetoric was pruned away, they're going to say that the withdrawal in 2011 was one of the worst mistakes we made.
I mentioned at the outset of the call that we only have Dr. Hansen until about 20 of the hour. We've got about a half dozen questions pending, so let's take another call right away. Go ahead, caller. You might have your telephone on mute. If you have your phone on mute, you need to come off mute. Okay, we're going to move on to the next caller. Reminder to be brief with your questions, if you could.
Yes, this is Bob McConnell. I agree with what you've been saying, Dr. Hansen. I just, because the emphasis seems to be on ISIS and the Middle East, and understandably so, I guess I just want to include that Putin continues as a malignant threat throughout the world. He's pushing in Ukraine and other places, and that is very much a part of what Obama has been seriously avoiding and staying away from, and something that we have to address.
Well, yes, I would agree entirely. I was just talking because I was asked to talk on the challenges of radical Islam, but he's been very brilliant as well. Why Obama deprecates him as a class cut up in the back of the room or somebody who's into macho shtick, he systematically prunes away and adapts and annexes the Crimea. He's got Georgia, probably eastern Ukraine, maybe the Baltic states, which probably would wreck NATO if he went in. And now you can see what he's doing in the Middle East. As I said, this arc is not just to prop up Assad. He doesn't care about Assad, but it is to create a bloc of nations. And let's remember that Putin exports 6 million barrels of oil per day, the Iranians 3, the Iraq 2. And when you get 12 million barrels of exported oil, and then you are the only power in the region to influence another 20 million barrels of exported oil in the Gulf, who have no patron now, de facto they have no patron since the United States has abdicated, then you can see that Putin may be able to control, through alliance and intimidation, half the daily export of oil in the world, and that would radically change the price of it, which is really killing the Russian economy and the Iranian economy. So he's got a very sophisticated geostrategic view, and I think the Saudis or the Emirates or Kuwaitis are thinking to themselves, and I think Putin is telling them, you better deal with me, because I'm a much better friend and a much worse enemy of the United States, and we have the same common goals to up the price of oil and get rich, and I'll help you in a way that the United States just won't do.
We've got about 10 minutes left and 5 questions, so we will carry on.
Well, hello. Michael Maybach from Alexandria, Virginia. Thanks for doing this, Victor. As you know, the European Union is at its heart a peace process, distrusting of nationalism because it's led to war. Now France has been attacked, and their leader says they're at war, and they've started to do something about it. Number one question is, will France persist in this, or will it very quickly move back into a more passive posture? Number two, what if Germany was attacked the same way? Would it ever get back into the business of war?
Those are good questions, and it depends when you use the term attacked, whether you mean serially attacked or on one occasion. So far, the pattern in Europe the last 20 years, whether it's the London or Madrid bombings, is that they can weather, or the Charlie Hebdo, they weather a particular attack, and then they take a breather, they get very angry, and then they don't do anything. Part of that is not just because socialism innately breeds that complacency, but they spend anywhere from 1 to 1.5% of their GDP on defense. And what does that mean? That means when the Charles de Gaulle goes out to the Mediterranean, it's smaller than a one of our 10 helicopter carriers, and that's all they have. And they don't have any transport capability or refueling capability. So when they say that they're going to systematically destroy ISIS, what that really means is that the United States is going to have to bring a carrier into the region, provide intel, provide backup fueling, repair, logistics, maintenance. And as far as the other question about Germany, that's sort of been the mystery of the last 70 years, because the anomaly of World War II has really warped the German problem. I mean, it doesn't have nuclear weapons, whereas France and Britain do. It's enormously powerful. It's got the fourth largest economy in the world, and yet it seems to be both struggling under right and left tensions, and it wants to participate, but it's got this legacy of 100 years of negative attitudes about any participation. But again, I don't think it's immune from the fact that if they attack and they hit Berlin, and then they would hit Frankfurt or Hamburg or Munich, and they would do it systematically, they would stop the immigration in a second, and they would get very angry. But of course, that didn't happen after 9/11. It didn't happen after the subsequent attacks, because they were isolated and they were not sustained in serial.
There are quite a few callers left. We'll try to get to as many of you as possible if we could carry on.
Hi, Victor. It's Ilya Shapiro at Cato. I'm wondering, you said that 55% of the people are still sane. Do you think that the American people are ready for kind of the nitty-gritty of foreign policy, that it's not simply kind of Bush democratization everywhere versus doing nothing, or at best lobbing 20 bombs into the desert like France just did, that there's an appetite for a good strategy to actually contain ISIS and prevent their modus operandi and prevent their being able to export terror?
I think it depends on the catalyst to change public opinion. You know, before Pearl Harbor, Charles Lindbergh was a national hero, and 75% of people wanted to keep out of another border war in Europe or leave Japan alone, and suddenly overnight, you couldn't find anybody who was an isolationist. The people hadn't changed, but the people's minds had changed, because they felt that they were dealing with an existential threat. So, again, should some of these things continue, if we have another Paris attack next week and then it's followed by one in Washington, then you won't see that democratic debate go on like it has been the other night, Saturday night, or you won't see people for the New Republic or Huffington Post having the same resonance. They will continue to say the crazy things they do, but they won't resonate. Right now, it's sort of like, you know, you get in a fight and one person hits you, or you're in a shooting match and you just stop for a second and you want to see, where is this going? Is it going to escalate, or is both sides going to back off? And ISIS, we know, won't back off, but it will be predicated on to what degree we step up to the challenge. And if they hit us again, eventually people will rise up. There will be Curtis LeMays and George Pattons that will come out of the woodwork, and we will use them, and we'll defeat the enemy. Then we'll ridicule them and say, you're a warmonger, get back in. But it depends on the provocation, the level. If you have a soccer mom in Palo Alto who votes for Obama and, you know, thinks global warming is an existential threat, and she wakes up one morning and the Stanford Library is blown up, believe me, that woman will want to use every means necessary to protect her children.
We'll take at least one more call. Let's see what's on the mind of this next caller.
Hi, Victor. Nina Rosenwald at Gatestone Institute. Great briefing. Thank you. I was wondering what one might say to these jihadis to try and neutralize them, or turn them around, or calm them down, to bring them over to our side? Or you can't?
Well, that would be sort of like saying you can take a Bolshevik over to your side, or you can take a Nazi over to your side.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that
okay.
They won't come over to your side, and it doesn't mean that propaganda and even sincere persuasion is not useless, but it has to be accompanied by the use of force. So what I mean is, you couldn't shut up Hitler before Stalingrad. The guy went out every week and radioed and did this, and then after Stalingrad, he wouldn't utter a peep. Everybody had a copy of Mein Kampf on their shelf in 1940. Nobody did in March of 1945. So you have to discredit, defeat, and humiliate this and say to people, if you want to go down this road, this is where it leads you. You're not only going to be defeated, you're going to be humiliated and a laughingstock. And then people will listen to you. So when the French say that they're going to, you know, investigate, everybody knows what the French mean. They're pretty tough people. They don't have a Bill of Rights. They're going to go in now, and they're going to investigate people, and they're going to do some really tough stuff, maybe. And if jihadists feel that this is really scary, then they're not going to be so loud and arrogant. And I think even in the United States, you're going to see just for a little bit that Islamophobia is not the chief threat, and you're not a racist, nativist, xenophobe because you're worried about more migrants. And so I guess what I'm saying is that when these existential threats become real and you go on the offensive and defeat people who you thought are undefeatable, or they, or you didn't really, you know, you want to be magnanimous, then these people start to change their attitude. So, you know, as my father said, just to finish the conversation, he was in a B-29, and 2 days later he found a 5,000-foot runway and their crew landed. And I said, my God, Dad, you had 70 million people you'd bombed. What happened when you landed 2 days after the armistice, the surrender on September 2nd? He said, they met us with flowers. So they met you with flowers? How could that be possible? And he said, because we had a whole tarmac full of napalm back on Tinian, and we were told to go back there immediately and firebomb the entire country. And I said, well, you wouldn't have done that. And he said, we would have done it and like to do it. The point I'm getting is that there was nobody in Japan in 1946, 1945, 1947 who thought Tojo was a savior. So the only way you can discredit these movements is to defeat them. And you're right, you can do it through propaganda, you can do it through argumentation, you can do it through demonstration, you can do it through foreign aid. All that's valuable. I'm not deprecating soft power. But ultimately, when they get to a state where they want to kill you, you have to kill them and discredit them and humiliate them. And once that happens, you'll be surprised how quickly people distance themselves from them.
I think
nobody in the Middle East, I'll just finish, nobody in the Middle East anymore is saying that they're a pan-Arabist or a Ba'athist or they're pro-Soviet or they're pro-Nazi. And yet at any of the last 5 or 6 decades, the whole Middle East professed just those ideologies. But once they were discredited, the people just went on to the next. And that's kind of a depressing thing because it's never going to end, but it's like mowing your lawn. You can do the maintenance and you can do your daily chores and have a good life. And we have to avoid this idea that human nature is malleable and we're suddenly going to win the ultimate victory. Everybody's going to sit down and we're all going to be friends and we're all going to be on the same page about, you know, it's not going to happen. But it doesn't mean that because it doesn't happen, we won't have good lives as long as we're vigilant.
Let's try and sneak in a final question here. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, yes, my name is John Bernard. I'm a retired first sergeant in the United States Marine Corps. And I have a rather unique perspective on all of this, in part because I served for 26 years and understand war strategy, but secondarily because I lost my son August 14, 2009, during the Battle of Dehana in Afghanistan. And I had sent a letter some time ago, which will, this is preemptive for my question, actually asking my legislative representatives if they could please put the word forward that that fighting within the construct of counterinsurgency doctrine was a no-win situation. There was no possible way to win. And we've been hamstrung by that for 70 years, and then we've been hamstrung since then by failing to recognize the enemy the way he recognizes himself. We choose to come up with a concept of who he is, impress it on him, and then go forward, however hamstrung by the rules of engagement, which are a part of counterinsurgency doctrine. Can you tell me how you anticipate seeing any kind of a conventional win ever again, much less in the Middle East, against this recalcitrant enemy within those two problems, within those two false?
Yeah, I tend to be sympathetic, and I'm very sorry about news of your son. Anybody who's lost a child knows what that's like. It's terrible. And all I can say is that there's certain laws of war about what makes a one side win and one side lose, and it's when collectively people feel that it's not worth the cause that they're fighting for because it brings too much general destruction, pain, and mayhem. And then, therefore, they're going to alter their political views and accept the political premises of the enemy. And that was somehow lost in counterinsurgency, which based, I think, a little bit too much on the therapeutic notion that if we put a nice park in the Shia area of Baghdad, or we do this or we do that, then the natural humanity within these people are going to appreciate our magnanimity and we're going to get to a certain situation. I would say that when the two times I went to Iraq and watched in the height of the surge, what made the surge sort of work was that counterinsurgency was valuable as a veneer. So when you talked to Petraeus or all these officers when you went over there, they kept assuring you that we were building forming the water for the fish to swim in, and this, the landscape was holistic, et cetera, et cetera. Then the more you talk down the ranks to sergeants, they say, don't believe them. We're killing people like you won't believe. We are killing Al-Qaeda. We're killing Baathists. We're killing everybody, and yet we can do it now because they have this euphemistic veneer. I don't know if we did that in Afghanistan to the same degree, but that was a very brief moment that seemed, along with the Anbar Awakening, to restore deterrence, and that's what you want. You've got to restore deterrence, and I'm afraid that the counterinsurgency method forgot that. And I learned that when I was asked by the military to speak to a group, and I was the only non-anthropologist among the people talking, and they all talked about this and that. And all I said was, when George Patton went into Germany, he didn't really care to talk about Goethe. He didn't really care to master the customs and the protocols of traditional German life. He really didn't care where people in the village liked him or not. And there were some similar counterinsurgency type of movements for a while. He just wanted to make sure that he was respected and feared. Didn't mean he was imperious or committed atrocities. He just felt that there could not be a peace unless the enemy thought it was defeated. And to defeat the enemy, he had to accept a level of damage and discomfort. And then once he did that, his mind would change and he'd accept a particular strategy. Now, whether that's accompanied by a traditional conventional invasion or a bombing like we haven't seen, I don't know. But there is, I'll just finish this conversation, but it's very dangerous when you hear people say that we're in a new world or there's new trends or there's new ideologies or there's new technology. There's nothing new under the sun. It's just a matter of what degree of classical deterrence you want to achieve and how much you're willing to price to achieve it. And right now we haven't reached that point. It doesn't mean that we won't very soon if we're attacked again.
I mentioned at the outset we had Dr. Hansen until 20 of. We've used up that budgeted time and a few minutes beyond, so thank you, Dr. Hansen, with apologies to the audience who's didn't get to their questions. We certainly appreciate you, Dr. Hansen, joining us and even exceeding your obligation here today. So thank you so much for joining us. To the audience, just a reminder that our convention is now wrapped. All the convention video is online at the Federalist Society's website. Also check the website and monitor your upcoming your emails for upcoming Teleform conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.